Statewide satellite distribution of this program is made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.
This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist Dr. Alan Chartock of the State University.
Hello and welcome to the Legislative Gazette. This week, conversations with Assembly Speaker Mel Miller, Senator Walter Floss of Buffalo, and Senator John Perry of Rochester about revenue sharing, gay foster parenting, the super colliding Adam Smasher, and the state of the minority Democrats in the state Senate. Also, a last look at the surrogate parenting issue that came up this year and is being set aside until next year. That's all ahead on this week's edition of the Legislative Gazette. New York Assembly Speaker Mel Miller is continuing to spend his time trying to iron out details on legislative compromises with Senate Majority Leader Warren Anderson and Governor Mario Cuomo. One of the important fiscal problems still to be worked out is how to appropriate revenue-sharing dollars. One of the most boring parts of Albany to a lot of people is when the revenue-sharing discussions come up. And so the question I have for you today is, you have a disagreement with Senator Anderson. What is it?
I think it's the way you do revenue sharing. It's the formulation. Now, who gets and what percentage of the revenue sharing pie? How do you distribute it among local governments?
A lot of people don't even know what revenue sharing is.
Revenue sharing is something that started years ago following a Federal Revenue Sharing Act, which was a way of state government to give unrestricted money to local government. And what I mean by unrestricted money, you have an education budget. So you give the school districts money for education, and that's, you use it for education. The state gives money to local districts for their portion of the Medicaid, for their portion of welfare. The state gives certain transportation aid formulas. And there are all kinds of formulas where the state really redistributes a significant part of the income. I think in New York State, about 70% of state tax collections, general fund tax collection, that's sales tax and income tax, go back to local government. But most of that money has to be spent as directed because it's programmatic in nature. Revenue sharing was to share part of the state's tax bounty with local government, and that money was to be used as local government saw fit. And the whole function was to try to come up with an equitable formula as to how you share this money among the various localities, be it a village, towns, counties, and cities. Those are the four subdivisions. And the disagreement pretty much between us and the Senate has been, how do you distribute the money? Who gets what percentage? How do you figure out need? What are the elements that make up the formula? Are all villages the same? You know, some villages are full service. They're much more, they function like cities. Some aren't. And I think that's what the dispute is about.
Well, but where would the Republican philosophically position be different from the Democrat?
I think there is a little division on the Republican end because traditionally you would find Democrats going towards the municipalities and the Republicans would go towards towns and counties. Interestingly enough, this year we've gone to cities and counties, and the Republicans have gone a little bit more to towns and villages in their formula, which creates the historic fight between counties and towns. Historically, the Republicans would the counties would do extremely well on the formula. The counties do better under the Democratic formula than the towns. It's almost like a new alliance or a realliance.
Mm-hmm. Why is that, Mel?
I don't know.
Politically.
We use need as a very real factor. Need and the amount of services the local government provides. You know, there are local governments that provide fire and police and sanitation, and there are local governments that don't, and they can be called a village or both be called a city or both be called a town. I think our feeling was what you call yourself ultimately doesn't mean a lot, is what kind of service you provide for the people who live in your jurisdiction and the tax effort that you make to meet those services. And those are the determinations we made. And you, if you go back a little bit, when we came out with our formula, the Municipal League of New York State supported us, which is made up of towns, counties, villages, and cities. The towns have broken away because the Republican formula is better for them, but that doesn't mean it's a fairer formula.
And the Association of Counties?
Are with the Democratic, have supported the Assembly formula.
I was looking at something in California, switching to an entirely different subject, Mel, and that has to do with foster parenting and gays. The other night, Michael Dukakis was being picketed because he would not allow gay males to be foster parents. Do you think that the gays who picketed him have a point?
That's hard for me to say. One, the tradition on foster care would be given to a female, forgetting the fact whether the male was gay or not. And so I think that you would start with that. I don't know if there's a right and wrong. I suppose there are gay men who would make marvelous foster parents, and you should value the foster parent as to the kind of love and care they can give to the foster child, not particularly because of their sexual orientation. However, I don't know how many times they do foster care or give a foster care to a single parent. See, I really don't know. Mm-hmm. And that may be an excluding factor right up front.
So you don't have any philosophical
problems? I don't have philosophical problems. It's tough to get good foster parents, and we should go and get the best we can find.
Okay, and then the question of the Supreme Court of the United States. I know where you stand on capital punishment. They have a major ruling this week which says that you can't consider what happened as a result of a murder. In other words, if five kids couldn't be fed as a result of that murder, that could not be considered by the jury that was considering the punishment.
I think that's the correct standard. You're measuring a punishment for a crime. And to impart knowledge of the criminal. It's a terrible that this person had a family and this person didn't have a family, and to make the crime more grievous because of external factors, I think the Supreme Court was right. I'm very surprised at the decision from this court.
Well, but don't you think that, as I do, that justice is not being served then, that this all these questions enter into an evaluation of whether justice was done in a case?
Well, I don't think you ever do justice by imposing the death penalty.
So it's not so much the where you...
And I don't know how you define justice. I mean, I can make the argument you shoot somebody X and you shoot him in cold blood, and you shoot Y in cold blood. I don't understand why the sentence should be different, because Y may have had a family and X didn't. That has nothing to do with justice. Justice is, relates to the crime you commit, how you committed it, and why. I don't think there are. I think the other factors are extraneous.
Democratic Assembly Speaker Mel Miller. The super-colliding, super-conducting atom smasher was the topic of a meeting this week of the State Senate Commerce Committee, which met to discuss the potential advantages and disadvantages of the project. The federal government in the next year will be deciding where to site the physics research project, which will provide thousands of jobs and international prestige. Senator Walter Floss, chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee, told the Legislative Gazette's Leslie Brokaw that the committee has begun very preliminary discussions on what the state would have to do if the project is located in New York.
When you figure $6 billion is going to be spent on it, and it could create 4,500 construction jobs and permanent jobs of 2,500 to 3,000 thereafter, with another 500 people coming in on an annual basis that would be visiting scientists, when you realize all of the services that would be required for a complex like that, another great economic impact. And then the prestige for whatever one of our universities were within the proximity and could utilize the services. I think that one of the great things at SUNY Buffalo that's in my district, when they received the earthquake center, it's things like this that makes our university system stand out. And in my district, the university is the largest employer of people. So I'm looking at it from that approach.
We've been hearing a lot from state leaders about the advantages of locating the Collider Project here. What kind of concerns do you have? What kind of preparations should the state do to try to buffer some of the drawbacks that may come with it?
Well, right now, I think everything has to be done in stages, and I don't think you cross bridges before you come to them. And it's only another month away that they have to submit the proposals, and they've narrowed it to three locations on a broad brush basis. And then in December, the federal government will make a site selection of six sites. Now, if we're selected then I think we know we're in the finals. Then I think the time would be to start looking at the impact, such as we're having with Fort Drum, you know. What will the federal government expect in the way of infrastructure and schools and housing, et cetera? And then we'd apply it to that site that was selected. There's no sense now going through these environmental impact studies on three sites and then expending the money. We have a finite number of dollars to invest in. We're investing $3 million in this preliminary application. And I think that would suffice until such time as if the feds do select one or more than one site in New York State for the final selection, then I think that would be the time that we could undertake the environmental impact study of that particular site.
Okay, you mentioned infrastructure. The question of who potentially would have to help pay for the schools that might be needed, housing that may be needed. What other kind of things would have to be provided for a large complex like this? Will we have to figure out mineral rights for that particular property?
Well, those things would, yes, that the state would have to acquire the land. That's the big thing. And they would have to overcome whatever impediments there may be, such as the way of wetlands, et cetera, and have to satisfy DEC and EPA. And so those things would all be a matter of site selection and how they could work this tremendous thing in. It is not going to affect our highways and things like that, because once it's in, it's got to be a minimum of 50 feet underground, but they figure the average will be 100 foot. So roads and traffic lanes and train lines and power lines and everything else can still go across this section. So I don't think it'll have as much impact as some might think when you figure 16,000 acres. But the federal government does require that, or they do not share in any cost of bringing in sewer lines and water lines and it's a sort of a trade-off thing. Whatever community might be selected may have certain limitations of what they can accomplish within their own taxing base. Then it may mean that the state has to look at it as an economic development project and assist that local government in setting up the infrastructure.
Walter Floss is a Republican New York State Senator from Buffalo. He chairs the Senate Commerce Committee.
There are 61 seats in the New York State Senate, with 31 seats by a party constituting a majority. The Senate has for over 20 years been ruled by a Republican majority. In 1974, the Democrats gained about 5 seats, but they have held their minority status at a fairly steady rate of 26 members. One of the Democrats who came into the Senate in 1974 was John Perry of Rochester. He's been taking a look at the state of the Democratic minority, and he told Allen that it's unfortunate but not particularly surprising that the party hasn't gained any more seats in the last 10 years.
We came in with a new leader, Fred Orenstein, and it took us 2, 4, 6 years to really understand what we had to do on a statewide basis and to pacify, in a sense, the various people. Fred only won by one vote in becoming the minority leader of the Senate, and there were a lot of people that were never that enthusiastic for him because it was, in the city, in a sense, it was a reform against a regular type of situation. So we had work to do to put together an organization to understand statewide issues and statewide politics, especially for Fred, who was from West Side Manhattan.
Now, in the aftermath of some of the accusations that have been made against some members of your party about hiring people who were essentially there just to run political campaigns, and I don't want to touch on that for now, but in the aftermath of that, the party has asked you to take a look at what they're doing right or wrong. Can you give us some preliminary estimates on what you found?
Well, my position in the conference is chairman of the minority conference, and in that position, I'm essentially saying we have tried a certain plan over a period of years and we are no better off now than we were 6 years ago. We still have 26 seats. My judgment is that when you continue not to do better, in fact lose some seats where we have lost seats, we should look at what we're doing and reorganize.
I believe
we should emphasize issues more than politics. Mm-hmm. And what we have done in the past is more, in a sense, look at political strategy in an expedient sense, just before campaigns, especially when there were special elections, and not develop a broad-based program of policies and of issues that could be recognized on a statewide basis that this is what the Senate Democrats stand for. That's my goal.
Why hasn't that been done, Jack?
Because that was there was a different emphasis. It was a belief that you could do things in a quick and dirty way, in a sense, coming into a campaign, that issues were not that important. And that, you know, that's a conventional wisdom. A lot of people still believe that issues are not that important and that candidates per se are more important than issues. Mm-hmm. The unfortunate thing is, I must say, that we have not had the success in attracting candidates. And the reason for that is that we do not have, in a sense, a farm system such as the Senate Republicans do with the Assembly Republicans who are anxious to leave the minority
I don't think a lot of people understand that the Republicans are in the minority in the Assembly, and
right.
therefore they would love to be in the majority in the
right.
Senate.
So
you don't have that. We don't have that.
And our farm system, in a sense, really should be county legislators and town board members mm-hmm. and city council members such as Nancy Lorraine Hoffman mm-hmm. and Ralph Quattrociocchi and Tony Masiello and Billy Stokowski. And myself, for example.
Named a whole bunch of Democratic successful senators.
And we were all in local government.
Yeah.
And we have not been able to attract that type of person recently. And I think what we have to do is to develop a program on a statewide basis that directly affects local governments, that people can say, these guys know what they're talking about. They know what they're talking about on solid waste. They know what they're talking about on drinking water. These are problems that affect people across party lines, across income lines. I want to be part of that. That's what I am hoping to see county legislators say. I want to run for the Democrat on the Democratic ticket for the state Senate.
Assuming that you guys win, you get in the majority, and that there may even be leadership changes, could you be the majority leader coming from upstate with all those Democrats downstate, A, and B, if it weren't so, would you tell me so?
Well, I'm not sure that I could be the majority leader, just as I'm not sure that a speaker in the Assembly could come from outside of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I am confident that when we're in the majority that I would be in either a second or third position, possibly ranking member of Finance, or not ranking member, chairman of Finance, or something of that type. But it's a coalition type of thing. There is no way the Democrats will be in a majority in the Senate without more upstate seats. And therefore, the upstaters will hold the balance of power just as they do in the Assembly. And it might be very beneficial to upstate.
Do you think that the Democrats have a shot at taking the Senate in the near future?
Well, I think politics is like baseball, that you never know until that last man is out in the bottom of the ninth inning. There's a lot of variables involved. I believe there's going to be a lot of retirements. I think we're going to get an ethics bill. You may know more about that than I do.
Not I.
I think the ethics bill may force a lot of people to retire. In general, there are a lot of upstate Republicans who are much older than the average age of the Senate who may, like Bill Smith, seek retirement. I know that there are 3 to 4 seats upstate that we could win in a non-incumbent situation.
New York State Senator John Perry of Rochester. Fred Dicker of the New York Post, you have some strong feelings about the Senate Democrats. How are they doing?
Well, I think they're doing pretty disastrously, Alan. Not only do they have 6 district attorneys and 3 United States attorneys investigating them for criminal activity, but they're also, in the minds of many people, including myself, a lackluster or nondescript collection of New York City-dominated lawmakers who, in years and years of trying to make themselves the majority party in the state Senate, have failed miserably. I think by virtually all accounts, they're poorly led, they represent nothing, and their prospects are bleak for the remainder of the century.
They say, in their own defense often, that the question of reapportionment, that the Senate Republicans have been allowed to play with the reapportionment in such a way as to virtually guarantee their continuance.
Hmm. Well, of course, let me just say this. If they were, in fact, failures and recognized that, would they admit it, number one? I don't think they would, and I think they are failures and don't want to admit it. But number two, it's just too easy to blame the Republicans, who, after all, are sort of an aged group of Rockefeller carryovers whose time is really running out on them because of the demographic changes in New York. The apportionment issue, reapportionment, the drawing of Senate districts is important, but the fundamental question is, what do the Democrats in the state Senate in New York State represent? I think the answer is that they represent nothing except a collection of lawyers who are looking to build up their law firms and boost their own egos, and as a result of that, they've been an ineffectual minority, and right now look like they have no chance whatsoever to take the majority.
Are you suggesting that they really haven't worked at it?
Correct. I'm suggesting that Fred Orenstein, the scandal-plagued minority leader, and his clique of followers have been far more interested in playing the game, the old-fashioned corrupt political game, of hiring operatives to go out and do a dirty tricks type campaign rather than developing issues that would truly distinguish them from the Senate majority, the Republicans. And clearly we both know that there are plenty of issues out there that they could use for that purpose.
You say dirty tricks campaign. I'm aware of the fact that they're accused of hiring people that would go out and work for them full time on state line, but I'm not familiar with the dirty tricks.
Yeah, if you go to some of the districts in New York City, Alan, where the Senate Democrats have run races, you will see really slimy types of advertising efforts where they seek to link local people who they're running against to pornography. They seek to play games of misrepresenting people's backgrounds in order to try to defeat them. That's what I mean by dirty tricks. I mean, they play a very nasty kind of politics, which is not all that uncommon in New York City. I mean, that's the way they play games down there. But the Democrats in the Senate, my basic point is, have never distinguished themselves as representing anything other than business as usual.
We take a look at somebody like Jack Perry, an upstate Democrat who a lot of people say nice things about,
Bright,
aggressive guy. Could an upstate Democrat ever be the majority leader in the Senate?
I don't think you can ever say never, but it would be extremely difficult. It's very important to distinguish, Alan, between the upstate Senate Democrats and the downstate ones. The upstate Senate Democrats have to win their office through hard work against what are usually very potent Republican opponents, and as a result, the upstate Democrats tend to be far more interesting and able than their downstate counterparts, the downstaters from New York City. And keeping in mind that the Senate Democrats have nobody from all of Long Island, even though there are a sizable Democratic number of voters out there, the downstate New York City Senate Democrats invariably are the products of clubhouses of one type or another, and it's a Donald Manus nod which could get you elected in the old days, and that wasn't more than a year ago, as much as a real popularity with the voters. So, in fact, the downstate Democrats tend to be far less impressive than the upstate ones.
Fred Dicker of the New York Post. We'll be right back.
Republicans in the state Senate said this week that the issue of surrogate parenting, which the legislature began to consider seriously for the first time this year, will not reach the floors of the Senate or Assembly for debate this session. Senators John Dunn and Mary Goodhue, who are sponsoring the Senate version of the legislation that would regulate the practice of a woman having a baby for another couple, said the bill will not be voted on until next year. The Legislative Gazette's Maury Small takes a final look this week at the way surrogate parenting legislation has been developing.
Three different bills have emerged in the New York legislature to regulate surrogate mothering. The latest is sponsored by Assemblyman Gary Proud of Rochester. His proposal would ban any contract in which a woman receives compensation for bearing a child for adoption by someone else. Proud says the concept of surrogate mothering is Orwellian. He says the next step is genetic engineering, in which you could pre-select your child's sex, hair color, and other traits. Proud acknowledges that under his bill, people could enter into secret contracts for surrogate mothering, but he says they would be reluctant to.
They could have a contract, they could have an agreement, but if one of the parties reneges on it, how are you going to enforce it? You know, the case where the mother would bear the child and then does not wish to give up the child. You know, the party who contracted for that child and paid money for the birth of that child, you know, would have no rights to go into court and force the mother to give up that child. She could not be obliged under any sort of contract or agreement to give up that child. The analogy is making an agreement, a contract, to purchase an automobile. You know, you give the money to the dealer, and then the dealer says, no, I'm not going to give you the car. And if you can't go into court to enforce that, you're very unlikely to enter into those agreements.
Assemblyman Proud says the National Organization for Women, the New York chapter, and the American Civil Liberties Union have shown interest in and may support his bill. Another bill introduced in the New York legislature would make surrogate mothering legal. The measure, sponsored by Senators John Dunn and Mary Goodhue and Assemblyman Oliver Coppell, would require court approval of any surrogate contracts and psychological counseling for the natural mother and adoptive father. Also, the court would set the price the adoptive couple would pay. The surrogate or natural mother would then be bound by the contract to give up custody of the child. The third bill proposed so far by Senator John Markey would ban surrogate mother contracts for 2 years, at which time the legislature would have to reconsider the issue. With only weeks to go in the current legislative session, the three surrogate mother bills will not reach the debate stage until at least next session. They're sure to stimulate lively discussion when they do reach the floor and may well be joined by even more bills outlining different provisions on surrogate mothering. For the Legislative Gazette, this is Maury Small.
And that's it for the Legislative Gazette for another week. Our show is edited and produced in the studios of WAMC Albany by Leslie Brokaw. She had help this week from Maury Small and Dan Analek. Be sure to tune in next week when we'll be back. For now, I'm Alan Chartok.
The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the State University College at New Paltz.